Paul Young, I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, going great guns, going great guns.
What's it like in Bris Vegas this evening?
Balmy as per usual. We don't really have a winter up here, so no, it's all going all right.
Now, when you say balmy, are you referring to the population or the fourth-term premier, Mr. Beattie?
I think a bit of both at the moment. Everyone's celebrating. I'm sure you're quite proud as well as a former Bundaberg boy yourself, Cameron.
I don't admit that on this show, Paul.
So, we'll keep mate, really quiet.
Paul Young, about town PR blogger from Youngie, Youngie, good Aussie extension of the surname there, prblogs.org. Mate, welcome to G'day World.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to be on the first Australian podcast. I guess I'm one of the only PR podcasters in the Southern Hemisphere, along with Lee Hopkins in Adelaide. So it's great to be on the podcast that started us all off, Cameron.
That's it, mate. Just keep saying that. I'm the podcast that started off. I go to things now and people say, so I believe you invented podcasting. I go, yep, that's right. Yeah, I invented it. I'm prepared to bullshit my own hype. But that's right, mate. Welcome to the very first Australian podcast. And apparently we even get a mention of the BRW this week. Have you seen the BRW?
No.
Apparently.
Oh, what, the podcast network or?
Yeah, apparently. Well, my mate Richard Giles, my usual co-host, who is in Melbourne at the moment, because he and I are speaking at an event tomorrow called Strategic Corporate Communications, which you should be at, buddy. You should be talking at this thing tomorrow. They should be flying you in instead of Rich and myself. Well, they're not flying me in, but they're flying Rich in. But he told me that he saw that there's a big thing on podcasting and BRW, and then a guy from Howarth Communications, big PR firm in Sydney, Guy from Howarth sent me an email this afternoon saying, hey, congratulations, I see the podcast network got a mention in this week's BRW. Who does your PR? That's a big coup. And I said, mate, I can't afford PR. I just have to use my good looks and charm to get press coverage, which is probably...
Well, that's always the way you get into BRW, I think, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I've never been in it before. I don't even know that I'm in it this time. I'll wait till I see it before I believe it. But... You interrupted the punchline there, Matt. I was going to say, I have to use my good looks and charm, which is probably why I don't get any fucking PR, any fucking press. Anyway. So, mate, you're on the show not just because you bought me lunch. Did you buy me lunch?
No. I think Mark Jones might have picked up the...
Mark Jones bought lunch. That's right. Mark Jones...
Young PR practitioners try to avoid picking up lunch tabs wherever possible. So.
Yeah, no, you want to get the IT editor of the Financial Review to buy your lunch. That's the way to do it. when we caught up at the Pampa conference. But you were telling me about some cool stuff that you're doing, not only about PR and blogging and PR and podcasting. You're doing the anti-astroturfing campaign. Lots of cool stuff. So that's what you're here to talk about. You know, and I'll start with my usual pitch, and I guess we can play off of that. As I think I mentioned to you when we caught up, you know, I sort of spend quite a bit of time talking to PR agencies and online agencies and advertising agencies and the like at the moment. And one of the common refrains I have for them is to ask them how prepared they are to help their clients, if they're an agency, deal with blogging and podcasting, both from a proactive stance, how do they take advantage of these tools to build deeper, richer communications with their customers, partners, investors, etc., but also how they handle it from a defense perspective. For, you know, I talk about the Kryptonite bike locks example, I talk about the Boston.com example. In fact, this is a bunch of stuff that'll be in my presentation at the Strategic Corporate Communications event in Melbourne tomorrow. And I personally feel that the vast majority of PR people that I meet in this country are wholly unprepared for what to do if one of their clients gets bitch-slapped by the blogging and podcasting community. And they're wholly unprepared as to how to educate their clients to deal with these sorts of situations. I mean, as a PR practitioner, do you think that's a fair call, or am I missing something?
No, I think from my perspective that I definitely have to agree with you there, Cameron, because basically it's all very new, all this social media stuff, Web 2.0. And as a fellow podcaster and blogger yourself, I think you understand as well as anyone that to really understand it, you have to be out there getting involved in it, trying out the tools, getting involved in the conversation. Until you're out there and having a go at it, you can't really understand it. And when you look at most of the Australian PR industry and where they're at with this, they're not involved in it at all. There's only about four Australian PR people who are blogging themselves. There's very few agencies that are getting involved with it. So I think that the majority of the PR industry in Australia is either not aware or not aware of the significance of blogging and podcasting and the like. And there's also still very much a control atmosphere out there as well. They want to be able to control the message. They want to be able to control the conversation, well, even if there is a conversation. Whereas if you're going to succeed with a blog, with a podcast, with social media, the first thing you're going to have to do is relinquish control.
Yeah, now you're talking there, if you're using these as proactive tools to get a message out there. And I guess one of the other concerns that I have from the PR agency is, the example that I use is on this show a couple of months ago, I cold called an now ex-friend of mine who's a product marketing manager at Microsoft, a Windows marketing manager, and I said, mate, you're on the show, give me the top five reasons why people should buy Windows Vista. And he was like, no, I don't want to comment and I don't want to talk on the podcast. And so I made fun of him a little bit and then actually put that in the show. And that upset him and his minders and his handlers. But there seems to be this lack of preparedness that, whereas in the past, companies could sort of deal with the media kind of on their terms to a certain extent and get their message out, and it was all very controlled. And when the media approached them for an interview, they sort of did it on their terms and whatever. These days, they don't really understand that anybody they're talking to could be a blogger or a podcaster. And saying, well, no, I won't talk to you, and expecting people not to then run that is, I don't know, kind of naive,
yeah,
I think.
That's right. And then whatever they run was going to live on forever within Google as well.
Exactly. And that's the other thing that I don't think they understand, is that the impact of screwing this shit up isn't what happens that day or that week in the press cycle. It's the fact that that lives on in your Google rank forever. If it gets picked up by the blogosphere, the top 10 results when anyone searches on your company or on your product is going to be how you screwed up. And you can't buy that back. Doesn't matter how much money you want to throw at it. It's very difficult to buy back your Google rank. It is doable, but it's extremely, extremely difficult.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd also, I doubt that the majority of the PR industry out there as well is kind of taking a big notice of Technorati and the like. Really, if you're in PR these days, you should be looking for all your clients. You should be searching for all of them every day in Technorati, in Google. You should be doing as much online monitoring as you can, because it's so easy to do. But the question is, are people doing it? And yeah, as you said, from a crisis management perspective, things can just blow up in the blogosphere, which I guess a good example that I've been involved in was with the anti-astroturfing campaign.
So why don't you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I can go into that a bit for you, Cameron, for people who aren't aware of it per se. Well, it started off, I wrote a post at my blog after I read an article that I got forwarded from Overland, which is a literary journal based down in Melbourne, that outlined a really dodgy event that was funded by the Public Relations Institute of Australia. And it featured a speaker called Ross Irvine, who seemed to be tied in with a lot of right-wing astroturfing groups. And astroturfing is the creation of fake grassroots organisations. So anyway, in this case, I wrote a post about it, just saying, oh, look at this, I've just read this article, I'm a new practitioner, I'm not an authority on this kind of stuff, but what's going on here? This seems really dodgy. Suddenly in the comments, all these senior people in the industry jumped on board, such as Trevor Cook, who's Australia's best known PR blogger, one of the best known out there, a whole bunch of others from around the world. And then we decided, why don't we start up a bit of a movement about this to get some more debate happening, to see, you know, express our opposition to it and see if we can work towards putting a stop to it. So we did that, and it really took off from there, to the point where it was talked about around the blogosphere by some of the most significant people within the comms blogosphere and overall. Steve Rubell's posted about it. Seth Godin's posted about it. It's been discussed in depth on For Immediate Release, which is the leading PR and Marcom's podcast. There's also been a number of agencies that have signed up, so it's created this huge discussion, all stemming from something the Public Relations Institute of Australia did, for starters. And then if we look back at how the PRIA has handled it, for starters, David Hawkins, who's from the PRIA down in Victoria, left a couple of comments on my blog and joined the conversation a little bit. Then, all of a sudden, the PRIA released a statement on their website, and that's been the extent of the conversation. And since then, I've received emails from the CIPR in Britain about it, from the PRSA in America, and from a whole lot of other places who've, you know, tried to talk about it a bit, said this is what we're doing. Meanwhile, back where it all started, we're losing Google as well with the PRIA. There's been nothing, no attempt to join the conversation really whatsoever, and I think that's an example of people not getting it.
So why do you think people don't get it? Where do you think they're screwing up with this stuff? How hard is this to really comprehend?
I think it's very easy to comprehend once you're in there having a go at it, but the thing that strikes me whenever I'm talking to people is simply a lack of awareness that there is this, that there is a blogosphere out there, that blogs exist. I guess we haven't really had a huge influx of them in Australia. Duncan Riley's been posting over the last couple of days about how he was at a media conference in the Hunter Valley, and he was just really worried walking out of it. He actually said, I think that he's worried that Australia's in deep shit when it comes to social media and things, because people just aren't aware of anything about it. Most people I talk to about blogs have never heard the word blog before. Generally, if I'm going to start talking with blogs about someone, the first thing I'll do is, this is what a blog is, and you work from there. There's just really not the awareness, and until there's the awareness and still people start trying it out, then when is the PR industry isn't really going to get its handle around it.
Now, when you say people don't know, you're talking about people in PR don't know, or just people in general?
From my experience, it's both people in general and that. I don't move in high-tech circles, I guess you could say. I don't have a lot of geek friends. I'm probably kind of the leading geek amongst my peer group. But really, amongst the Australians I talk with, there's very little understanding. They're always interested by it. People are starting to get into podcasting a bit and listen to podcasts more often. But that's, from my perspective, yeah, it's a lack of awareness pretty much Australia-wide. And I've seen that reflected in a lot of blogs as well, and a few conversations about it. And I guess it's just the fact that, or it seems to be, that we're normally a few years behind the US and the UK on take-up, and maybe that's continuing. All right, what do you think, Cameron?
Oh, don't ask me what I think, mate. I'm doing the interviewing. No, the reason I ask the question is because I don't think it matters a damn if 95% of Australians don't know what Web 2.0 is. I mean, I don't think they should know. I think it's... And I don't even care if most people don't know what a blog or a podcast is. Well, no, yeah, I don't really. I mean, I think that what I hope that the general population keeps doing, and they're already, you know, doing this in droves, is finding new things to read and watch and listen to via the internet. You know, whether or not they know that this is a blog, or they know this is Web 2.0, or this is a podcast, I don't really care. I mean, what matters is they go, oh, this is something that's interesting to read or listen to. And I caught up with my buddy Richard Giles. We had lunch today, and we were talking about he was up at Phil Sims' conference. Well, I was supposed to be up there as well, Phil. Phil invited me up, but it was my kids' piano lesson on Sunday, and I decided to piano concert. I decided to stick around for that. But he was saying the same thing that Darren Rouse and Des Parros and I were up at the previous one of these conferences about 6 months ago, I guess, up in the Gold Coast, and we were speaking about blogging and podcasting, and it was a similar sort of thing that. There was either very little understanding on behalf of the media who were gathered there as to what was going on in this space, or they were extremely dismissive of it and very elitist and sticking their nose up in the air. But, you know, I don't really care, because it's like, I'm sure that I did an interview earlier today with a guy called Robert Cawthorn, who was up at PAMFA, speaking at PAMFA, and he's an American pioneer in online media, and he's a journalist. He was a journalist for 25 years, and you know, as he said, it doesn't matter whether they get it or not. You know, he said people who made the best horse and buggies on the planet in 1903 probably thought that they were going to be around forever as well. Doesn't matter how doesn't matter how good they thought their horse and buggies were or how arrogant they were about it. As soon as Ford started pumping out the cars and people could afford them, it was all over Red Rover. And I think we're seeing that happen with this stuff. So it doesn't matter if they get it or they don't get it, you know.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there, Cameron.
Matters to their shareholders. Their shareholders should be scared. But
I see that it doesn't matter whether the general audience gets it. It does. They don't need to understand all the inner workings of a blog or, you know, or whatever the technology is, so long as they're, you know, enjoying a new way to look at information. But a public relations practitioner, a professional communicator, we do need to be the experts, because our job is to communicate with the public's free organisation to try to start a two-way conversation, develop a relationship. We need to be everywhere where our audiences are reading, everywhere where they're accessing information, everywhere where they're absorbing some media. We want to be able to understand that and work out the best way that we can then talk to them. And so for public relations practitioners and professional communicators, we really do need to be experts. It doesn't matter whether the audience is or not. It just matters that they're reading it. But we need to be able to work out how to use it, what the best way is to use it, and also what the best way is to use it within a strategy to reach certain people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, yeah, and let me ask you this question. What do you think needs to happen for PR practitioners to get the wake-up call? Do you think it's going to take a major disaster of Old Testament proportions for PR people in this country, a local one? You know, is it going to take you know, a Telstra or a Fairfax or a BHP to get bitch slapped by the blogosphere or the podcastosphere for everyone to wake up? Or, I don't know, what do you reckon?
I think that we'll probably see a flow-on effect through the global PR firms. When so many of the big global PR firms are really chasing this stuff hard, like your Edelmans and your Weber Shandwicks, Ogilvy PR overseas, when they're all really getting into it overseas, you're going to see this flow back towards the Sydney offices. For example, Ogilvy PR, they've got some great blogs and the like on there. Overseas, and you were recently talking about how you were talking to someone from Howarth's about this stuff there within the Ogle family here. So you're going to see that flow on come back through, but I think the real big eye-opener, yeah, is you're right. The first big kind of blogosphere-led public relations crisis we see come out there, that's going to make a lot of firms sit up and take notice. But I think people are starting to get interested, but it's just a very, very slow process. I'll be interested to see when we get some more Australian PR bloggers out there to join the three of us, or the four of us who currently exist. So. And also, it'll be interesting to see whether our professional association takes a bit of a lead on it as well. Because I know the PRIA is group on new media within there, and also there's a guy who works at the PRIA, works on their membership site, who's really into all this stuff, and you can see a few things starting to flow through. So I think it's really, we're going to see a trickle-on effect from overseas leading through the big global agencies, and that's going to kind of shape the way the local PR scene looks at it. That's my perspective anyway, but if there is a huge, big huge big crisis that makes everyone shit themselves soon, it might hurry it up a bit.
So, you know, if you were in charge of the new media strategy for a client, let's just say client X, and they make widgets. Let's take some examples. Let's pick a big company. Who's in a lot of trouble at the moment? Telstra. You don't have Telstra as a client, do you?
No, I don't. No, I'm not sure that I want to.
Hey mate, our connection's just gone pretty.
But yeah, that would be a big major one. So you're talking about
I think we got a lot of lag. Yeah, got a lot of lag. I'm going to hang up.
48 megabytes a second here.
Okay, let me hang up and just configure a couple of things on my router, and I'll call you back in a couple of minutes. Did you get that?
No.
I'll just hang up. I'm going to configure a couple of things on my router, and I'll call you back in a minute.
Okay, no worries, mate. G'day, Cameron. We're back.
Ah, we're back. We'll see how that goes.
No worries. I'm at about 36 to 54 megabytes, so I think I should be right.
It's not doing any better here for some reason. It's still flaky. Might be my wife using Citrix and taking up my all of my bandwidth downstairs. I don't know. Anyway, we'll keep going. See how it goes.
Yeah, no worries, mate.
So I was saying, mate. Let me start again. So if you had a client, let's say a big Australian company in a lot of trouble at the moment, Telstra, and you were devising their blogging and podcasting strategy, what kind of things would you be recommending they should do?
Well, yeah, Telstra would be an extremely difficult one. Obviously, the thing about blogging and podcasting is that they're communication tools that you use as part of a broader strategy. So you'd be looking at the whole strategy of what Telstra are trying to do, who you're trying to communicate with, and then you look at those groups and think, are they an appropriate one for a blog or a podcast? Also remembering a big problem with Telstra is that a lot of their problems are in the bush, and in the Australian bush, people just simply can't listen to podcasts and can access some blogs. The other weekend, I was out at a mate's place at WeWar in the northern New South Wales countryside, and he had never, ever listened to a podcast, because it's just way too big for him to download. The best they can get is dial-up out there. And he'd hardly visit a blog because the internet's painful for him. So that's one thing to take into account. But I guess what I'd be trying to do would be advocating as much as possible inside the company for them to try to relinquish control of the message a bit and go out there with the purpose of trying to listen to people. There's been always a big focus within PR. We've always talked about two-way communications, but we've never really nailed it. But the best practice PR, you want to be doing two-way communications, listening at least as much as you're talking. And the thing is, something like a blog can give you the opportunity to listen and engage in a conversation with your people who are interested in your organisation. So Telstra have a huge opportunity there. They've got a lot of annoyed customers. There's a lot of difficult issues out there. Perhaps by openly engaging them in a transparent conversation, they could get some good results, but that would be extremely difficult. Podcasting as well, there's a huge opportunity there. It's so easy to put a podcast together. I think you understand that, Cameron. Obviously, there's some difficulties there to make it sound really, really professional, but it's such a simple thing to do. A company like Telstra has an extremely diverse group of shareholders and stakeholders interested in information. You could be targeting communication down in little bits with different podcasts and different blogs for different people and starting a whole conversation there, and that's where the opportunities are. So it's difficult to look from the inside and say, here's some simple tactics, bang, bang, bang. But the thing is that look at the potentials of this new technology to actually have a conversation, to listen to people, to hear what your customers want, talk back to them, and also just be transparent and be credible. And that's a great thing for your brand if you do it properly. But if you don't want to listen, you know, properly.
So this whole issue of let go of control, obviously the concern that PR people have and the lawyers that shadow them have is that if they let go of control, stuff is going to get said, which is going to damage their reputation, perhaps get them into legal trouble. How do you recommend they deal with those sorts of issues?
Well, yeah, there's definitely always legal concerns out there that you need to be aware of. But the interesting thing as well is that there is this thing about control, but PR people have never, ever controlled the message. No one's ever controlled the messages. There's always been a conversation out there. You've never been able to control what a journalist chooses to write about your company. You've never been able to control how people receive the messages you send out. So the first thing to think about is that there's never been control. The next thing to look at is, I guess control doesn't matter so much. As long as your goals are good and as long as you're trying to listen and you're trying to get involved in the conversation, if you're trying to do the right thing and you're open about that, the fact that you are trying to do the right thing, generally you're going to try to come out all right. That's a simplistic way to look at it, but you've got to look at everything on a case-by-case basis. But generally, the fact is that there's never, ever been control. It's just on the internet, the conversations people used to have at home, now these conversations can be global. Interested people around the world can talk about a project. I'm sure there's a Vegemite community that's globally dispersed that can now for the first time be united talking about Vegemite. I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here. But the fact is that now these conversations that have always been out there that you've never controlled, they're going to happen online, and your choice is, Do you be part of that conversation and do you talk to people, or do you just shun it, pretend it doesn't exist, keep on controlling the message, let people talk about what they want online, where it's going to get remain in Google forever, and step back from it? I don't know, I would advocate relinquishing control a bit and going out and getting involved in that conversation that is happening out there already.
Hmm. And what about in terms of, you know, the blogs or the podcasts that the company themselves starts to put together? I mean, I was in a meeting this afternoon with some people from very, very large Australian company, and we were talking about doing a podcast for them, and there was a bunch of ideas that they were sort of going around the table of stuff that they wanted to do, and to me it just all sounded quite, I don't know, dry and dull and boring. And I listened for like an hour, and then I said, well, look, I got to be honest with you. You got to ask yourself, why do people listen to podcasts in the first place? When they have so many different things they can listen to out there, watch, read, why do they listen to podcasts? And I think a large part of it is because the things that they are, you know, the things that they have to listen to on podcasts are engaging, they're entertaining, they're compelling, and or they're highly targeted to their area of interest, you know, their niche of interest. Yeah. And I'm concerned that a lot of corporates, so we had this whole discussion then. I came up with some ideas that were fairly crazy out there for what they should do for their show. And they were like, oh, well, no, we'd never get that through legal. You know, our senior executives would never agree to that. It's way too honest, basically, or way too, I don't know what, you know, confrontational for them to have that sort of open dialogue. And there's an example that I use a lot of time in my conversations. You obviously know who Robert Scoble is.
Yes.
Now, when Robert started blogging for Microsoft a few years ago, I think the thing that really grabbed everybody's attention was that he was occasionally critical, openly critical of Microsoft's you know, policies or products or strategies or things they'd said in the marketplace. And he would be openly, you know what, that doesn't make sense to me, or I don't know why we did that, or that sucked, or, you know, we should have done that better. And because he was willing to be grown up enough to criticize the company and take it on the chin, he had credibility with his audience. You know, and then over a period of a couple of years, what happened was, you know, as soon as any news broke about Microsoft, good, bad, or indifferent, the first place where a lot of people in the IT industry and journalists covering the IT industry went was to Robert's blog, not to, you know, Microsoft.com/press, not to Microsoft.com, not to their PR people. They went to Robert's blog to find out what was going on, because Robert had credibility. And he was an honest voice, and he was perceived as being honest and credible because he was prepared to admit stuff that they weren't doing very well, rather than just giving this highly crafted message, obviously. And this is basically what you're coming back to before. But I find, you know, I tell that story probably every day in boardrooms and meetings and cafes across the country to people inside of corporates, and I find that they just, you know, they're just horrified at the thought still of telling people what they think. You know, this company I was with today, who will remain nameless, but again, very big company, and they were saying, well, you know, we're a trusted brand, people trust us. And I said, oh, hold on a second, do you really believe that? And they said, yeah, absolutely. And I said, you know what, I reckon if I went out and took a poll of 20 of my friends and said, do you trust this company or this sector, the vast majority of them would go no. And so either I'm completely out of touch, or, you know, we're coming from it. And they said, well, oh, okay, so people may not trust, you know, the brand of the company, but they trust the individuals that they deal with in the company or something. And I said, you know what? A great idea for a podcast would be, you don't like us. That would be the topic of the conversation. You know, I was in sales for many years, and one of the first things...
That'd be ballsy.
Well, it's not only ballsy, it's good psychology. You know, one of the first things that I learned in sales was in fact, a guy said to me very early on, Cameron, I can do his voice, he was an American, Cameron, people do business with people they like and trust. And, you know, I learned very on in my sales career that the way to get people to trust you is to tell them what they're thinking. So, for example, when I worked for Microsoft, and if I went in to meet with a CIO, I knew a couple of things. I knew that the CIO thought our products were crap and they were too expensive, generally speaking, and that open source was kicking our ass. So, you know, that had always come up in my first conversation. You know what? You know, if you're like most CIOs, you probably think our products are, you know, not best of breed. They're probably more expensive than they should be, and that we're about to get our ass kicked by open source. And they'd go, yeah. I go, yeah, you know, I've heard that a lot, and it seems to be the common consensus. And all of a sudden, when you have that conversation with somebody, instead of being in an adversarial position across different sides of the table, all of a sudden you're kind of on their side, and then they go, well, this guy understands what I'm saying. And I'm saying the same thing with blogs and podcasts. You know, if you go back to Robert's story, right, by him getting on his blog and going, you know what? You know, basically saying, you know what? You guys think this sucks. And everyone goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, I want me too. All of a sudden, you're on the same page. And but this is just seems to be such a, you know, you should have seen the looks around this boardroom table when I was suggesting this today. They were, the people around the table were looking at me like I, you know, I was smoking some sort of drugs that were going to make my balls shrivel up and fall off. Yeah, it was, I don't know why people struggle with this so much, man.
Yeah, so I guess, Cameron, have you heard of the Edelman Trust Barometer Survey? Not sure if it's one you would have come across, but...
No, tell us more.
Just back to what we're talking about here, about the big thing about trust, and the reason they're trusting Robert is because it's a real person talking out there. The Edelman Trust Barometer Survey, I hope I get all this right, because I'm kind of talking off the top of my head. It's a big survey done by Edelman, which is a global PR agency that does a lot of the leading stuff on blogging and podcasting out there. They're really getting into all the social media stuff, where Steve Rubell works, amongst other well-known bloggers. Anyway, they did this big survey all the time about what kind of communications we trust, and they rank a whole lot of different things. Their latest ones found that the big thing they found from it was that people trust a person like me. So that's where a lot of the power of blogging and stuff come from. This is why Edelman's heading towards all this social media stuff, because people trust someone that's like them, a real person's voice. They don't trust corporate gobbledygook anymore. They've been, you know, knocked around by that too many times. What they don't trust, like you said, Microsoft.com/press. What they trust is Robert Scoble. He is a real person speaking in a normal conversational tone, and he's being honest like a reasonable person would do in a conversation. I guess it's like if you walked into a party or someone, and someone walked up to you and put you in corporate speak, you would think, who is this freak? Whereas if someone came up to you, said g'day, had a chat with you, wanted to listen to you, you're going to want to talk to them a bit more. So highlighting what you're talking about there is, and that's what the Edelman survey has found, which is a global survey. Journalists ranked quite lowly. Corporate communications was quite low. Independent experts ranked highly, as you'd expect, but the big thing that came out of that was people trust a person like me, a real voice that's out there, and people trust blogs, and you know that's where a lot of it's coming from. Exactly what you're talking about with Scoble. And trust is something that you've got to build over time as well, which is what Scoble did. He didn't instantly start his blog and want to just, you know, always sprout the Microsoft line, but the fact was that he was out there for so long, speaking credibly, speaking transparently and being truthful, that he built up a relationship with a huge amount of people who, they know Scoble. People know Scoble, they know what he stands for, they know what he's about. So now he can write pretty much anything, people are going to believe him and people are going to want to believe him because of that relationship and because of that trust. You build trust over time, and it's very easy to do with a blog if you're doing it properly.
Yeah, I'm just having a look. I Googled it, and I'm having a look at the 2005 results from the Edelman Trust Survey. It's interesting.
Yeah, hopefully I wasn't completely wrong.
No, you're doing pretty good there, Matt. A person like yourself experienced a significant jump in credibility as a spokesperson in both the US and Europe. 22% in January 2003 to 56% in January 2005 in the US, and similar numbers in Europe.
Look at that. That's a big jump.
That's a massive jump, isn't it? And look, I think you've just hit the nail on the head with that, Matt. I think that... You know, it's a very important lesson for corporations to learn and for PR people to learn, is that, you know, people want this genuine human conversation. So then, you know, where this usually goes in my meetings, and they go, well, We agree that it has to sound like genuine human conversation, but we want it tightly scripted and run through legal first.
Exactly.
And I keep saying you can't script human conversation, and then they go, well, you know, it gets done for television shows all the time. I'm going, yes, but that's why people have stopped and watching television. In fact, I was in a meeting with a lady at an agency earlier this week, late last week, and she made a fabulous point. You know this TV show we've got here, Thank God You're Here?
Good show.
Australian listeners will know probably what I'm talking about. Basically, for our international audience, it's a comedy TV show where basically they get three guests, usually comedians, on the show, and then they have a cast who are playing certain roles, and the comedian sort of just gets thrown into the middle of a situational comedy kind of scenario, and they have to ad-lib their way into this situation. They kind of have to figure out from what other people are saying and the outfit that they're wearing, who they are, what their character is, what they should be doing and saying, and the person who pulls off the best, you know, ad-lib wins the show. Anyway, and it's not a very good show, quite frankly. I mean, I've seen a couple of episodes, and I think it's pretty lame. But it's rating its ass off in this country. And this lady I was with said that the reason she thinks it's rating its ass off well is because it's obviously unscripted. And, you know, well, at least the ad-libbed bit is unscripted. And she said people are, you know, so unused these days to seeing anything unscripted. Even, you know, most people realize today, even reality TV is fairly scripted. So the one show that is unscripted is getting a big response. You know, I keep trying to say in these meetings to people, you know, people have an inbuilt bullshit meter for this kind of stuff. I don't care how good people try and read a script and make it sound like it's not scripted. At the end of the day, you know, we know if it's scripted or not scripted. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the way I look at public relations is that it's about forming relationships. And if you want to form a relationship, there's quite a few things that go into that, but there's things like it takes a lot of time and you've got to build trust with people, and you've also got to be able to talk with them in normal terms and also listen to them. And all these things that are the best ways to form relationships are very easy to do with blogs and with podcasts. And that's where the big opportunity is for PR with it, is because the new technology that we're getting here is so good at creating conversations. It's so good at forming relationships. It's amazing how many people that you can meet and get to know and feel like you know personally by reading their blog and commenting every now and then. And that's the things that we can learn from it. Why do these work? They work because there's a two-way communication. They work because it's someone talking in a real voice about things that they care about, and their readers care about the same things. There's a common interest in there. So yeah, the big thing out there is that they're real people talking about real things. And if you go back to kind of like the party analogy I was talking about before, the old kind of poor kind of publicity practice of public relations would be sending out a mass press release. Imagine you walked into a party and you had to tell someone about, you know, XYZ is really cool, you want to check it out. Would the best way to do it be to walk in the middle of the party and start screaming at the top of your head, come and look at XYZ, it's great! Or would the best way to be to go in there, to talk to people, to listen to what they want, to let them know a bit about it, take some feedback, change it around? I think that's where it is. And that's really what it's all about. The fact is that now that with this social media, you've got a huge opportunity to be able to talk with people on their terms in a real conversation. And that's what people are turning towards. They're rejecting all this corporate bullshit.
Very well said, mate. I like that. Public relations is about building relationships. Very good. Hey, mate, 36% of Americans in a recent Ohio University poll believe that the Bush government either deliberately actively participated in the 9/11 attacks, or knew that they were happening and sat on their hands and allowed them to happen. What would you do if you were in charge of public relations for the Bush White House?
Oof. That's a big question, Cameron. So we're looking at on that issue in particular, or the rest of the problems overall.
just in terms of getting people to like you and trust you again if you're the Bush White House.
there's going to be a lot of things to that. One of the most important things in a relationship is trust, and trust is something that you've got to maintain, trust is something you've got to build, and trust is something you've got to work at. And I think the Bush administration has worked against that for quite some time. So there will be the first problem. There's probably a lack of transparency in there as well. I mean, those stats about the World Trade Center are just astounding, though. I think views like that you're going to really struggle to change, but it might be more an indication of a lack of education or something than anything else. But I think there's a few cornerstones that they've turned their back on, which most of politics have turned their back on, and which is why most politicians are completely untrusted, is the fact they don't communicate transparently.
Hold on a second.
Everything is really tightly scripted. They don't listen to people. They don't have any trust, so they're never going to form a relationship with anyone. This is why people hate politicians. It's purely because they've turned their back on everything that's at the foundation of a good relationship. They've turned their back on trust, they've turned their back on transparency, they've turned their back on a real conversation, and they've turned their back on listening. So I think the Bush White House and a lot of politicians all the way out there have a lot of work to do to get people to trust them.
Are you suggesting that the 36% of people who think the Bush White House was involved is too high a number? Because I think it's too low a number. I'm thinking, I thought like 99% of the population would believe that. I mean, what...
I thought what you were saying was that they believe that the Bush government was actively involved in the attacks.
Yeah,
is that as in
orchestrated them or knew that they were going to happen and sat on their hands?
Oh, that's a big one for me, Cameron.
Come on. Hey, thinking about politicians and what you were saying about people like myself that we trust. I was telling this story to this big company in the boardroom today. Do you know who Andrew Bartlett is?
Yeah, Democrat senator and a blogger. Good bloke. Good to see him trying it out anyway. I think he's the only Australian politician blogging.
Brisbane boy like yourself. When Andrew, you may be too young to remember this, but a few years ago, Andrew was the leader of the Democrats, and he was kind of boring, particularly after, Natasha Stott-Despoja, and, he doesn't have her looks or charm. He was fairly boring, and then he sort of resigned under a bit of a...
Yeah.
Black
a bit of a red wine cloud.
Yeah, he got drunk and allegedly, grabbed some female senator on the arm or something. Anyway, yeah. I mean, my interaction with him was very little. I knew very little about him. There's no way in hell I would have ever voted for him. And then I noticed he had a blog, and I was reading his blog, and I thought he was writing some good stuff. And then I invited him on my show, on this show. I don't know, probably a year ago, I think, Costello just released the budget, and I reached out to Bartlett and said, why don't you come on the show? And he did, and we got chatting not just about the budget, but, he explained the fact that he's a huge Nick Cave fan, had never missed a Nick Cave concert in 20 years, except for the most recent one where he was locked up in some debate in the Senate. And he was pissed off about it. And he's a huge Tom Waits fan and, Iggy and the Stooges. And he used to go to punk nightclubs when he was, a young bloke. And he used to, DJ on a radio station in Brisbane. And at the end of it, I said to him, man, if I'd known any of that about you, I would have voted for you. I mean, if I was in his electorate. It's because at the end of the thing, he's sort of my age, he's in his mid to late 30s. At the end of the conversation, I went, shit, you're just like me. You're just a bloke who likes Nick Cave. I mean...
Yeah, there's a real person under that politician suit.
Exactly. And I, to me, that was a huge sort of, surprise and wake-up call as well, is that these guys and girls need to be taking the opportunity to let people know that they are just people like us. And I think blogging and podcasting is a great way to do that. I mean... Bartlett does write a terrific political blog. And, when I had him on the show too, I said, because obviously, he's not paid to agree with the coalition, but I said, they've been delivering budget surpluses for 10 years. Do you reckon they're doing a good job? And he said, yeah, you know what? Overall, I think they're doing a pretty good job. I thought that was an astounding admission to get out of him, but, he was honest about it, which says a lot about the guy, He didn't trot out some party line.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. But politics in this country, like everywhere else, is so tightly nailed down and buttoned down and scripted, and there's minors left, right and centre, that really, it'd be very surprising to see anyone except someone from one of the minor parties coming out with a blog and the like. Though there is a Labour Party blog of some sort out there. I've clicked by it but haven't read it. Yeah, I don't know exactly what the story is. But, yeah, the thing is that there'd be very few politicians, I think, who'd be willing to join the conversation.
If it Kim's Beasley, they'd be like, I ate 5 Big Macs today. Today I ate a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken.
There's probably a potential top 100 in techno right in that. I'm sure it'd be interesting. The comments would be great.
Kim Beasley's blog saying John Howard's a poo-poo pants and stuff like that. Did you see that? Did you see that footage where Kim Beasley, again for our international listeners, Kim Beasley's the leader of the opposition party for about the fifth time, had a couple of cracks at becoming Prime Minister of this country and can't get it through his head that nobody wants him. But did you see where he had that stand-up fight with the old
Parliament? Oh, by Tucky, Wilson Tucky.
Tucky, with Tucky. Yeah, wasn't that right. That was Parliament. The best bit of television I've seen in a long time, them just getting stuck into each other in front of all
the journalists. Yeah, and again, why did that interest people? Because it was unscripted. Because for a second, instead of seeing him just standing there with a field of microphones trotting out his key messages, we actually saw a bit of a real confrontation, and we thought, oh, hang on, they're real people. They might throw a punch. And actually, I just had an idea for a great vlog as well. I remember a bit of a sidetrack. How about the great walks of John Howard? Every day, a 10-minute YouTube video of where Johnny's walked that morning in the tracksuit. That'd be great. That'd be fantastic. There you go, Liberal Party, if you're listening. Next election.
There's a free
365 days. Yeah, that's a freebie, all yours. You, just one YouTube video, just John Howard for 10 minutes walking along in the tracksuit. That'd be great. People would love it.
Paul Young, thanks for coming on the show, mate.
It's a pleasure, Cameron. Yeah, very much appreciate it. It was great having a chat.
All right, mate, I'm going to cut it there. Listen, I put up a show just a couple of hours ago, so I won't put this one up. I'll put it up tomorrow or the day after or something.
Yeah, no worries, mate. I'm subscribed, so I'll see it come through in my feed readers when it comes. No, that was really enjoyable. I enjoyed that. It was good. So.
Yeah, thanks for having you on, mate. It was good.
Yeah.
All right, take care, buddy. Cool. Talk to you soon.
I'll let you go, mate. Talk to you soon. Cheers.
Bye, mate.
Bye.
I really hate those podcasts that start off with all the loud rock and roll music.
Ooh, I hate screaming commercials.
Especially when you can hear Hawaiian music while you're learning about a Macintosh.
From the island of Maui.
On the Mac Help from Maui podcast.
Listen, you might learn something.